for BBS Radio. This is Health Frontiers with Lexi Ross. Tonight we have kind of a controversial topic in that we are going to be engaged with Dr. Alice Rose, who's a Primal Scream therapist. Primal Scream therapy has been around, I guess, for some 20 years. Is that right, Alice?
Yes, it was started in 1972, I believe.
Well, and have you been practicing since that time?
I've been practicing since 79.
Wow. Well, it's a field that, you know, a lot of people don't have much knowledge about. And I was wondering, I'd like for us to just kind of get into the basics and how it came about and how you got involved and why you believe it's so effective.
Okay. Well, I think people think that it's some sort of weird process where people just scream randomly and maybe use a lot of rage and get their feelings out. And it's much deeper than that, really. For one thing, I've found it to be incredibly healing for any number of disorders, both physical and mental. For one thing, it cures depression rather quickly. I've treated a lot of bulimic patients that they stop throwing up in about a week and a half. If they work really deeply with me, and they all work deeply, but I mean, if they stick to it, they'll stop the most dangerous behavior. I've seen it work in all kinds of cases, even psychosis. That takes a long time, but still, there's a relief in symptoms in a very short time, a matter of weeks. People do have to keep working, though. They can't stop. And then one of the most important physical disorders that I've worked with is cancer, and I've seen some amazing results with it.
Well, now, who was the originator of Primal Scream Therapy?
Arthur Janoff. He started it in L.A., and I studied with him for 2 years.
I see. Now, is there a certificate or a certification or something to be a Primal Scream Therapist?
He has his own certification process, and at the time that I was there, he held on to people for so long that I just left knowing that I couldn't get in 10 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I have a PhD, and I have my own certification.
So you're a psychology and you're a psychologist in your own right.
Yes, absolutely. And so really, any psychologist who... Actually, you do need to do the process yourself for a matter of years, probably 2 years, before you could sit for anyone else. That's what we call it, sitting for the client. But really, people are certified in other ways than by him.
I see. Well, what would happen, say, for instance, if I came into you with a problem? What would the procedure be?
We do an interview, which is standard for any kind of beginning of psychotherapy. And then on the second session, we start down into the deep emotions. And basically, it has to do with the compassion of the therapist. That acts to open up the person. And there's ways to speak and talk gently that just guides the person deeper and deeper into the feeling they're feeling in the present.
So you're talking about taking them into childhood memories, traumas. What I mean, this can address just about any situation, is that right?
Absolutely. PTSD responds very well to it, for example, post-traumatic stress disorder. You start with an emotion in the present. Suppose, for example, someone felt like they were never going to get a girlfriend, you know, that they'd never find anybody, that no one loves them. Instead of talking them out of it or using coaching, which is sort of a technique that says, well, what can you do to solve that problem? You don't do that. You go deeper into that feeling of loss and sorrow and not being loved gently. And as the person deepens it, the sobbing, really primal is much more about sobbing than it is about screaming. The person just kind of lets go, and as the emotion intensifies, it is automatically, by one's own psyche and one's own body, it automatically guides back to the original wound, which might be having been abandoned by one's parents emotionally or physically, that type of thing.
Well, you deal with even problems that emanate from the womb, don't you?
Yes, that's the latest thing in Primal, actually, that I studied that for about, well, maybe 17 years. Somebody regressed wildly enough in my clinic. They regressed to being a fetus, and I was shocked about 17 years ago. I was floored, absolutely floored, and I trusted the process, so I let them keep going. What they were crying about is something similar, the loss of a lover. They had left that lover years before, almost 6 years before, and just could not get over that loss. And as they deepened the sobbing and just, they were howling, really, with the agony of it, they felt themselves become smaller and smaller and smaller until they were a fetus, and they realized that they had lost a twin in the womb.
Oh,
and so, yeah, a whole, unbeknownst to anyone, they were only 11 weeks old. We figured it out. This took weeks of work. And when very often the parents don't know that one twin has died, that's a typical case. This was
How would a parent not know there was a twin?
There weren't sonograms back in those days. There was no sign of it at the birth. Very often, the little tiny twin can be crushed into the placenta. I mean, the dead one. It's dead. But it's, as the other twin grows, the surviving twin grows, the other one is crushed into the placenta, and the doctors don't search, you know, because it wasn't a known thing. For years, it hasn't been known about.
Interesting. Yeah, you would think that the doctor would recognize that there might have been another entity in the body, you know.
Well, now they are recognizing it because of sonograms. Doctors are finding twins all the time in there, and then some of them are not even telling the mothers because they know that these twins don't last, and they don't want to, quote, upset the mother, quote, but when they take another sonogram, the twin is gone. So actually, the person that is the most wounded by this is the surviving twin. And there are many characteristics. I used to specialize in this. There are characteristics of surviving twins. For example, they are always on the search for a soulmate. That's one example. Or they may feel like they can't sleep alone. They feel just awful if they have to sleep alone. Or they may feel like, if in the case of an identical twin being lost, they feel like they're half a person. And in another sentence they'll say that's a clue is they'll say, I was born guilty. And that's because the surviving twin feels that they have done something that resulted in the other twin's death when they really might not have.
Oh, interesting. Well, can you give us an example of, say, you know, when you say they scream, obviously there's some part of the session where people, you know, transcend from, say, crying to anger or what. And does that happen in every session? Do people get to the point where they can scream their anger, or, you know, how does that evolve?
What works with what happens usually with the range of emotions is that many people start their session in rage. And it's odd because you feel just, as you're listening to it, you don't feel horrified by it at all. I don't feel horrified. It feels like a relief to have someone doing their rage, having their rage responsibly. I used to work in a padded box where they could just kick the walls and pound and all of that. And then, so most often, I'd say 20% of the people start in rage, and other people don't even do any rage. But then it drops into the sobbing, and that is the most healing part of the session. So the screaming might happen at the beginning, and then it's more like a surrender, a deep surrender to your innermost material, your innermost self, really, and the person begins this loud wailing and sobbing. And that's when the memories begin to come. Sometimes there are memories associated with rage, but not all the time. The memories are important because they go back to the wound, the original wound, kind of like we're digging out an infected wound and getting rid of the toxic material in it.
So you feel like just ordinary, say, psychology or counseling doesn't really, ever get to the root of the problem if they're not... expressed emotionally, is that the philosophy?
Well, I do feel like that because I don't believe, for example, ordinary counseling could bring about, and I'm going to say this very carefully, but a remission in cancer. You don't hear about that much, you know. And I've seen some miracles happen when people really did get down to it. I've seen all kinds of physical miracles. One person had... hammer toes clear up in 1 hour.
Really?
Yeah, and those are considered genetic.
That is amazing.
Yep, and I've seen a lifelong rash clear up that nothing could touch. This person had had a rash for 12 years, and in a two-hour session, the rash went away and it never came back. And I just don't think talk therapy can touch that, can do that. Can bring about these kind of transformations. The other transformation that happens is a transformation in personality. And every psychologist who's worth their salt will say that a person's personality is pretty much set by pretty young, you know, maybe 7 or 8.
Is that right? That early?
Yeah, really early. And to see it change drastically and to see behaviors kind of melt away.
Give an example of what might melt away in someone.
A phobia of some kind. This whole case I can't reveal completely, but a person had actually a fear of maps. Maps. And that's a very strange thing to be afraid of, right? They couldn't open a map in a car to get directions. They were constantly lost. And we found out that a map, a relative of that person during a highly traumatic event had opened up a map and put it in front of the child and demanded that the child read the map, which the child just couldn't even do. There was no way. And high trauma was happening at the same time, and that behavior dissolved completely in a couple of hours of session, and they could read maps after that. That's a very simple one. But there's so many things that I've seen change.
You work with couples, too, in relationships, don't you?
Yeah, I've done pioneering work with that. I'm probably one of the only ones in the country, but what I got real interested in is how couples fall out of love. And in most marriages, I believe, that does happen, that after a while, the couple's no longer in love and they no longer want to have sex with each other, or at least one half of the couple doesn't want to have sex. Many times it's the woman. And then they're pretty miserable. The man... And it can flip around. The woman can be more highly sexed than the man. This is a stereotype. But by and large, I'd say about 70% it was this way, and then I've seen it switch the other way, where the woman wanted the sex and the man did not. But through this deep process, I've been able to help them restore their love and their passion for each other. And they'll fall in love again, like it was when they first met. I had one couple married 12 years, and they were on a plane. They were deep in the process, and the stewardess said, "Are you on your honeymoon?"
Oh, that's good.
That was. And well, that the odd thing about that work, since I got into the womb work, it often goes back to events that are in the womb. This is why we lose our sexuality.
Well, I mean, like, for instance, what problems you know, would have prevented? What problems did you have you addressed in specific couples that
okay.
helped them heal the relationship?
I'll give an example of impotence that happened. This person has given me permission, so. This is very hard to believe, but it really has to do, I have to speak before I can get down to the actual case history. In our work in the womb, we have found that consciousness is there in the conceptus, we call it the conceptus, immediately.
So the soul enters the womb upon...
Yeah, the soul. It really has to do with spiritual matters. I mean, what's interesting about this is you can be completely secular, and if you do this work, you will become spiritual. It is automatic. Anyway, so the consciousness is in the soul, and it is in the fertilized egg immediately.
Amazing.
And it's more like sensation and actually, oddly enough, visual. There is like a psychic visual ability in the egg. It knows that it's searching to land an implantation. This is going to be really wild for your listeners to hear.
No, we have some very fascinating shows on here. I think our listeners are pretty sophisticated, so you don't have
okay.
to hold back.
Okay. Well, in this case, now we're talking about impotency. There was another piece. Oh, this one case went this other way. Okay. So there's actually even a consciousness in the sperm and the unfertilized egg, which is really hard to believe. But I would say probably 6,000 people have relived this and find it to be real, and we're coming up with the same data over and over and over again.
Is this among a number of practitioners, or is this 6,000 cases that you yourself have conducted?
I have done about 2,000 cases, so I would say maybe nationwide 10,000 people might have relived all this. It's very, the work takes time so that you don't get a lot of cases. You get one-on-one, you know, you just get a limited number because a person may work a whole year with you, and that's only one person that you're working with. So probably nationwide there might be 10,000 cases. Anyway, we've got so much information on this, and the information keeps repeating itself even though these people aren't in contact with each other at all, and they haven't read anything about it. So here's what happens. When the sperm approaches the egg, and this is William Emerson's work. I studied with him. When this thing happened in my clinic, I knew I needed even more training, and I went to California and trained with him.
Now, who is William Emerson?
Yes, William Emerson in California.
No, I'm saying who is William Emerson?
He is a PhD psychologist as well. He's done a lot of work on this, and so has a psychiatrist named Graham Ferrant, who's dead now, but there's a whole body of information and research that's been done, clinical research, by both of these people.
Okay.
So, when the sperm approaches the egg is huge on the horizon. It looks overwhelming, and just to some, there's some people, others have other feelings, but many, many, many people, when they get into this scene, this is what they see, and the egg looks like it's going to engulf the sperm.
Really?
And indeed, this could be received for some listeners. When the sperm penetrates the egg, the tail is like it's been severed, like a guillotine has cut it off, and the poor sperm loses its mobility. So
really?
There is a terrible feeling of being engulfed by the female, and the loss of mobility and the loss of freedom if a man were to bump to a female.
Would you repeat that? There was a click on the line. I'm not sure.
Okay. What happens is this this, all of us have these memories of the earliest moments of life, and they're deep in our unconscious. None of us know we have them, but they operate almost all the time. So in this particular case, this male patient had told me that, well, for one thing, he was impotent. Okay, whenever he was going to get close to his lady, he withdrew, and he had sexual problems so that he could not connect with her physically, right? He relived those earliest moments of life, and that night he was fully potent. There was no problem with impotency.
That is amazing.
It was wonderful. And what I wanted to say, an interesting piece about his case was, I don't know if you remember this television show from just years and years ago where this huge ball, I forgot the name of the show, it was a very strange show, but this huge ball was on the horizon and on water. It was bouncing around on water, and it was gigantic. And there was a man in the, this was the promo to the show, and they played it every time, and this man was running from the ball. He was trying to get away from it. And the man said, this client said, that scene on TV every week used to frighten him. The specter of a giant ball.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's the image. You know, sometimes I think movie makers, of course, they know all this stuff in their unconscious. And they produce a lot of it on the screen.
I bet.
Yeah, a lot of it. It comes out in art and film and things like that. But anyway, that's a case of something physical being healed.
So in other words, during the crying or the sobbing process,
mm-hmm.
then they go through a series of identifying various feelings, right? And those deep feelings just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper in some cases.
Yeah, it's more like surrendering to them. There's not much cognitive process till the very end. So they kind of yield to it and get deeper and deeper and deeper, and then some of this stuff starts coming out.
Well, that would, the Christians would be very happy to hear that news.
I know.
Well, you know, from what I've learned about your process, Alice, is that you consider this whole process that you take your patients through as being a very spiritual one, and sort of, you know, there's a lot of new age, you know, quick fix
mm-hmm.
stuff going on right now that
that
are, you know, it's just leading people into a down a garden path of nowhere. And they, you know, this whole business of, you know, I can do affirmations and change my life. I can deny all the feelings. And I'd love for you to talk about that. I know you have some pretty strong feelings.
I do. Thank you for mentioning that. Long ago, I started thinking that this was an ancient spiritual path that Janoff didn't know he had stumbled upon. And indeed, Janoff claims to be an atheist himself. But as I went deeper and deeper into this process, I realized that it opens one to more and more of the numinous, of really the felt presence of God, whoever or whatever God may be. And there's some literature I have been reading that backs this up in several ways. Well, first of all, the deep spiritual practices are really, they have to do with an ordeal, not with something facile and quick fix and easy to do. But we are told to face ourselves. And the other thing we're told is to go within. Well, what if when we go within, there's nothing but pain in there? Well, that still needs to be faced and experienced and gone through. I remember reading autobiography of a yogi. And the other thing is I don't think the teachers in the East have told us enough about that. they seem to skip that part, but that doesn't mean that they don't go through it. When I read Autobiography of a Yogi, there was a scene in there, a description where someone came to the guru and said, so-and-so has reached samadhi. And the guru said, oh, he must have gone through weeks and weeks of hell. And that jumped out at me, and I thought, wait a minute, now you all didn't tell us about that. But
and samadhi is a state of bliss, right?
It's a state of bliss.
And the Autobiography of a Yogi is the story of Yogananda. For
Yogananda, it's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it.
Oh, yeah, it's been my all-time favorite.
I love it dearly.
Books, yeah.
I read it on a trip to India, and it was just a joy to be reading that and you know, reading his experiences. The other literature that I really dearly love is the Desert Fathers from the Christian mystics. And they speak about, they write about facing their passions. And their passions mean all that is within them, it really is not of God. So that's the anger, and it means experiencing it. It doesn't mean figuring it out, finding a way to skip it, or a way
Valium or Prozac.
Right. Oh, don't get me on that. My favorite topic. But they spoke about facing their demons, and they did, and they called themselves spiritual athletes. And the first one, Anthony, could be heard screaming in the desert.
Is that
I
right?
I love that line. Yeah, that as he faced what was within him, he was screaming. So, and there are other mystics from long, long ago that write of the dark night of the soul. Well, this will take one there, and actually it can be painful, but almost all the time, until you get to the very, very last and deepest levels, it is not painful. But it is a kind of willingness to take on your own suffering and to face it with a compassionate listener who holds your hand and who has really been there herself or himself and done the same and done it all. And one can tell when the listener has been there. There is a absolute calm and dear and sweet compassion coming from them as you go through what there is to go through.
So it's almost like you're playing out a role of parent reparenting in some way. I mean,
absolutely.
To be offering that kind of compassion and comfort and kindness, really.
Absolutely, and it's what no one really has had, and particularly a compassionate listener while you're screaming your head off, you know, or sobbing your guts out and not stopping you, someone not stopping you.
Because we're taught in this culture that we're not supposed to cry or we're not supposed to show our emotions.
Absolutely, and here's this person sitting there with tears in their eyes at times and just hearing you, it's a wonderful gift that you receive from someone. And it works. It takes you to your deepest parts. And afterwards, I like to tell the person to find their own way to sit in peace afterwards. Chanting, for example, in privacy, you know, praying, reading the Psalms, chanting Sanskrit, whatever that person is drawn to. And in those moments, there is such a feeling of the felt presence of God is there for that person.
That's wonderful, really. That's really a gift.
And the other day I discovered, through experience and a come to deeply believe in human experience, in our deepest, just facing and having our deepest experiences uninterrupted, that in this one person there was a moment in the womb where actually it was about an abortion that had happened of an identical twin. This can happen. They can be in two sacks. And Many twins, their twin is a beloved, is a beloved to them. They adore this other twin. They love them dearly. And one of them can be stronger and the other one weaker, and the strong one always is there trying to save the one that's on the edge of death, you know, and dying. And that surviving twin felt God's presence through loving, through dearly loving their little twin, and almost a tantric going to God through the beloved type of thing. And then when the abortion happened, they lost everything. They were left in a mother who obviously did not want her babies, and which was devastating. But not only did they lose lose the twin, the beloved, but they lost the felt presence of God. And she concluded that we come in knowing God and having that presence with us, and then something can happen that just snatches it away.
Well, now, you're saying that this woman had an abortion, but obviously it wasn't successful, that one child died and one...
Right. The mother thought they had killed the baby.
I see.
Not knowing that there was another one there.
Wow.
Yeah. And you can imagine the level of rejection and feeling not wanted. That's probably the most traumatic of all, to have a person survive an abortion of a twin.
I would think so.
Yep, it's pretty all-encompassing devastation.
I mean, you have to go through your whole life feeling like nobody wanted you.
Absolutely. And there's suicidalness that can come from that and all kinds of things. So, but the actual reliving of it, and then the actual reliving of losing God in that moment and kind of staying that way for decades.
I would think so.
Yeah, the person couldn't even pray. I mean, forget praying. They felt betrayed by God as well as, you know, betrayed by the mother, just nothing but betrayal. But they found that they could feel God's presence afterwards, or feel the numinous. I really want to say I'm talking about a general view of God, not any kind of religious view, but one's own personal
sacred presence.
View.
It would be a sacred presence.
Yeah. Sacred presence. That's a good word, the sacred presence. They could feel that. They could pray afterwards. They could begin to recover that sense of being in touch with sacred presence. And this is why I'm saying this is really spiritual work.
Huh. Well, I'm not going to let you get away without discussing the prolific use of antidepressants. Because... you know, there's so many people that don't realize the long-term effects of these drugs on their brains, how dependent, et cetera. And I would really love you to talk about that, Alice.
Okay. This is something I suspected. I heard a lecture, and I'm sorry, I'm getting old and cannot remember the scientist who delivered the lecture. He's extremely popular now and brilliant. And I'll start with this. He is a primatologist, and he found that the long-term use of psychotropics, that's what they're called, over time, over decades, causes a shrinking in the brain. And we should be alarmed by this. In Alzheimer's victims, their brains shrink. This is not a small thing. This is damage to the most delicate and some of the most important part of your body, you know, tissue, important tissue in your whole body. There's even been a place that's been identified, and I don't know how accurate that research is, but as a place in the brain that connects us to the divine. But, okay, so that's one little piece of data, but...
Now, let me ask you this question. When you're saying psychotropics, are you including all of the antidepressants and,
yes,
like marijuana, mushrooms, you know, all these other forms of hallucinogenics.
Okay, that's a different topic, and okay. I probably won't even touch on that. I worry about marijuana quite a bit. There is evidence of marijuana affecting the brain adversely.
Well, the research that I did many mm-hmm. years ago, probably at least 20 years ago, they
yes.
said that the THC actually stores in the fat cells of the brain and can cause dramatic mood swings.
Absolutely. It lowers the blood sugar. It can cause hypoglycemia, probably leading to diabetes. It causes short-term memory loss. And you should be alarmed if you're losing your memory. That means something is damaging you. Something's going on. Okay, that people laugh about loss of memory. It's serious. You should be frightened. You should go do something quickly if you're losing memory. And these kids are like 20, 23 years old losing memory. Believe me, don't take any drugs. And by the time you're 60, you'll be losing your memory all by yourself without any help from marijuana.
Is the same true of cocaine? Does that cause memory loss as well?
I have heard what will happen with long-term cocaine use and crack, that type of thing, is eventual, possibly Parkinson's.
Is that right?
Something else like that. So, but I'm not deeply into those things because I never used them in my clinic. I've had suicidal people. I've had borderlines. I never once had a drug prescribed for any one of my clients. No one ever committed suicide in my practice. We got through it without any use of drugs. And depression is such an easy thing to cure. It isn't even funny. I mean, yeah, that's the easiest one. And that's what everything is prescribed for.
I know.
People lose their sex drives when they use these drugs. You should be way alarmed if you've lost that and you're not old, you know, or something. If you're losing your sex drive at 30, you are in trouble because that is the life force. Your sexuality is your life force. It's your bond to your mate. It's your way to love in many ways. That's a problem with it, and this is what I deeply believe about it. I'm going to say something very radical here. I think that our way to God and to divine presence, let's call it that, is through our emotions. Now, some of the ancient mystics felt the same. Others thought it was through thinking, but about half of them said it is through our feelings and through our heart. If you take those drugs, your feelings will be dulled. The passion in your life will diminish. You can function real well. You can be a great worker bee, but you're going to lose the inner richness that is part of being a human being. And in losing that, and in losing your suffering, which is just part of life, you know, I mean, it isn't easy here.
Even if you're rich,
it isn't easy.
That's right.
Then you lose that possibility of divine connection.
And growth.
And all
the spiritual masters say it's only through adversity that we grow.
Absolutely.
So if you're eliminating, you know, that possibility for looking at your pains and your sorrows,
exactly.
How do you ever grow as a human being?
Exactly. And if you've ever met a person that has gone through sorrow and come out on the other end an advanced soul, you'll know what I'm talking about. There are fewer and fewer of them, it seems, but I've met many in my lifetime. You can look in their eyes. It shows. You can sometimes touch them and feel that deep presence and connection. And it's come through, they're going through their suffering willingly. So I'm real upset about the drugs. I don't believe in using them.
So it's hard for me to believe that there is a psychologist that has been in practice. How many years did you say?
Well, since 79. What is that now?
What is that? 30 or 40 years. And you still haven't resorted to drugs. I mean, that is really impressive.
Yeah.
Really impressive.
I'm one of the last. And now they're training us in their youth. And it's a kind of giving up, I think. Well, you know what? People just don't use this work, this primal work. They don't do it. They don't. It's real hard work. And they don't know that there's a way to not use drugs and to really feel good most of the time.
That is true. They don't. No one tells them that.
And actually, you can get to levels of ecstasy by doing this work, where not only do you just feel good, you can feel high. You can actually feel high from the relief and from just the joy of being, these burdens being lifted off of you. And the patient sort of just floats out of the office. The therapist doesn't always feel great. But the patient is like, oh, you know, I feel like 50 tons have been lifted off my shoulders.
That's wonderful. Well, Alice, could you share a few more cases or examples of how the primal therapy has worked for various things?
I had a client come, and she had breast cancer. It was metastasized, which is terribly serious. So that's like stage 4, probably. Was all over her body. She had refused chemo, and I don't know. She might have had some surgery, but it was back. The cancer had come back. And she worked, she's an unusual cancer patient because most cancer patients do not want to go through their emotions. That's their main problem, is they've tried to skip all of that, and they want to feel, they use a lot of, you would call them affirmations to get away from their feelings. They would say, oh, I feel good when they don't feel good. But she was different. She really got into it. And she was sobbing and howling, and all her stuff was coming up. And within 30 days, the tumors were gone.
That's amazing.
She was working hard, though. I mean, sobbing. We're talking almost every day for 3 weeks. And she would call me every 6 months and just say, Dr. Rose, I can't thank you enough. I'm still cancer-free. And she did that for 10 years.
Wow, that's impressive.
And, yeah, and she I was so worried about her when she left. I said, you've got to continue this. By golly, she had her husband doing it. She had her two children doing it. They were doing it in their kitchen in their apartment so nobody could hear them. She taught them how to do it, and they all kept on doing it. And I gave her a bunch of enzymes to take with her, and I know they helped some, but it was mainly, I really believe, the emotional work.
Well, you know, at the Gerson Clinic in Mexico, I had the privilege of interviewing Charlotte Gerson.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And she said that cancer is a disease of anger, and that when she gets patients, that she won't even take a patient unless the husband and wife come together to address the emotional issues in their family.
What I would say that cancer is there is a moment prenatally where one is about to manifest. This is wild stuff, but I'll track it. It's not always just anger. There's a lot more to it. And there's always anger. There, anger is sort of the surface of emotional problems for everyone.
Uh-huh.
But it's more about survival. And what happens is the egg, when the egg is an egg, when it's a globe, when it's round, it has a wonderful connection to the divine, and it feels like it could go back any time, almost at its own will. It could go back to, what do you want to call it, the heaven or the beyond or the unseen world or whatever. And when there's a moment when it elongates, and in that moment the cells begin to divide wildly, they just careen into division really, really fast. It's almost like a sense of blossoming all over the body, rapid, rapid cell growth. And there can be this dismay of, oh no, I'm gonna survive. I'm going to manifest. I'm gonna be born. And I don't want to. I don't want to be here. I don't want to do this. It's going to be really bad, and it's going to be really hard. And that core feeling is held in many cancer patients. And it's almost like classical conditioning, where A is paired with B in the nervous system or in the consciousness, and it's like wild cell growth is getting paired with, oh, no, I want to die. I don't want to be here. I don't want to come here.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And that is a core. There is actually a wanting to die in the cancer patient that's coming up in a deep, deep, deep way. And they've got to get that out of themselves. They've got to get that discharged.
Well, I want to mention that you also work with people who have had sexual abuse. All kinds of death traumas, family, child abuse, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to just, discuss that briefly. We're about to run out of time, but we cover that a little bit.
That is some of the hardest work to do. People, when they've been abused, they forget it almost immediately. I'd say 98%. I've seen, in all those years of practice, two people that remember being abused. And then so many of my clients, I don't suggest it to them, the soft memory syndrome is a bunch of hooey. False memory syndrome.
Oh, false memory syndrome.
Memory is a bunch of hooey. Don't even listen to that stuff. But another topic. But one will be just sitting there with the person reliving infancy with no mention at all of molestation, and then the person will begin to recall being molested. And it is horrific. It does more damage to a child than anything you can do to them. It ruins their ability to have a relationship. Zirkov said that the genitals are the seat of the soul. And that's a very interesting idea because, after all, the creation of a life occurs there, and there's a deep connection to the divine in the first moments of creation. Think of that.
Absolutely.
That might be what he meant.
Absolutely.
But when that is disturbed by an unwanted, there's such revulsion when one is molested. It's devastating. It's devastating. It's almost like it affects the soul. Not really. The soul's safe, always safe, but it just reverberates throughout the body, throughout the personality. There's nothing more devastating than that. You can beat a kid and they'll make it, but when they're molested, they'll be damaged. And it's hard work because there's a ton of denial. The person will often relive it, and then in the next session they'll say, that didn't happen.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. That's what I think happened with Freud. Yep. The patients came in and said, I made it up. I dreamed it up. It didn't happen. And you have to say to the patient, pay attention to your body. What is your body doing?
Ah.
That kind of thing. It's really hard work.
Well, Alice, is there anything that you would like to express about primal therapy that you would like to leave our listeners with? Because it is, kind of an unusual method. It's not widely accepted. And yet it's extremely successful.
It is very successful. And I think I've said a lot about it. I think the most important thing is it has roots in ancient practices that we have never known about. And I think it needs a lot more honor than it gets in this country. And I'd like to see that someday. But, yeah.
Well, you're a pioneer in the field. Really, when you think about it, if it's only 20 or 30 years old, it's a relatively new process.
It's a new process, and the prenatal part of it is very, very new. That has come out of the United States and a little bit out of England. R.D. Lang and Lake had started some of it in England. But we're the ones doing it here.
Tell me this. Is it practiced around the world?
No, No, I'd say America is the homeland of it, both primal and the prenatal work now. And we're the pioneers in it. There's two organizations, International Primal Association, which I support dearly. They're wonderful people that work on their stuff. And then the Pre and Perinatal Association has meetings. So,
is there a number that you would like to... Do you have a website?
I don't have a website. I'm not an internet person, but I'll leave my phone number if anyone wants to call.
Okay.
678-886-8680.
Well, Alice, we've been talking to Dr. Alice Rose about primal therapy, and I just want to say thank you for your time. It's a fascinating topic, and one that I've gained even deeper respect for, and I really appreciate you spending time with us, and I hope we can have you on again sometime.
Well, thank you, Lexi. Thanks a lot. Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Next week, we'll have a very interesting show with Joe Hayes, who has was suffering from Agent Orange, I should say, not Agent, Agent Orange, and he was able to heal himself. So we're looking forward to having him on this week, next week. And this has been Lexi Ross with Health Frontiers on BBS Radio. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.